Hello, Paul Barclay here with you. Welcome to Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/Radio National. You can follow us on Twitter at RN Big Ideas and subscribe to our podcasts via iTunes. Tonight, a new angle on our toughest problems. Matthew Taylor delivers the RSA's Chief Executive Annual Lecture. Founded in a coffee shop in Covent Garden in 1754, this organisation has grown considerably over the last 250 years. Today it has over 27,000 fellows. The RSA, or more formally, the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures and Commerce, through an active public engagement programme, plays host to some of the world's leading thinkers, innovators and intellectuals. In this evening's address, Matthew Taylor, a former chief advisor on political strategy to Tony Blair, argues there's a fundamental imbalance in the major forces of power driving progress in the modern world. He suggests we've lost faith in our collective ability to tackle important social challenges, but that this can be turned around. To find out how, let's go to the Benjamin Franklin Room overlooking the Strand in London. The title of tonight's lecture, The Power to Act, A New Angle on Our Toughest Problems. Here's the RSA Chief Executive, Matthew Taylor.
This is my sixth annual lecture. Going back to the very first one, I talked about a concept which I later described as the social aspiration gap. Excuse the jargon. And what I meant by that was the gap which exists between the kind of aspirations we have for the kind of society we want to live in and the trajectory on which current behaviour, current attitudes places us. And that gap is why it is, I think, that even though, despite the recession, austerity, we are a rich country. We are a country with many, many privileges and advantages, but yet it feels as though we've almost lost hope in our ability to solve complex problems. Problems like inequality and exclusion. Like, how do we have high quality but affordable public services? How do we provide dignity and care for an ageing population? How do we tackle long-term unemployment up yet again today? How do we modernise our infrastructure? How do we have a sustainable economy? Big complex issues where we don't really disagree. We all want, most of us want to solve these problems, but yet we don't seem to be able to. And I want today to look at how it is we span that social aspiration gap. And I want to argue that the bridge that we need to build to span that gap has got three core materials in it. And that's really the focus of my speech today. And before I tell you more, I want to do something which every single speaker in the country is doing right now. And you're going to get heartily sick of it very, very soon, I can assure you. And that is talk about the Olympics. So we are going to hear everybody laying claim to the Olympic legacy over the next few weeks. But I want to explain briefly why I think the Olympics was amazing. Because it was amazing. It was transformative. People who had no interest in sport were suddenly experts on slalom, canoe and dressage. And people like me, who are a little bit diffident about waving Union Jacks in the air, were buying Union Jack t-shirts and suits. So it was an amazing thing. And I think it was amazing because of this. Firstly, it was brilliantly organised. Now, we'd kind of almost forgotten that we could do something like that. You know, the stadiums were built and the transport worked and everyone thought something would go wrong and nothing did. Secondly, the whole country got behind it. It mobilised everybody. We were all enthusiastic. And I think everybody agrees that the most amazing thing was the volunteer army. That was the thing we were most proud of. And then thirdly, what is at the centrepiece of the Olympics? The heart of it. And that is amazing individuals and their efforts and their achievements. So that's why I think the Olympics were special, that combination. Because that goes to what I want to argue tonight are the three fundamental sources of social power. In fact, I think, but that's for a different lecture, that they are the three fundamental characteristics of us as a social species. And these three sources of social power are hierarchical authority, social solidarity, and individual aspiration. So let me explain a bit more. What do I mean by hierarchical authority? In essence, what I mean is all those people who have the right or think they have the right to tell us what to do. So politicians, chief executives, experts, strategists. That's what I mean by hierarchical authority. By social solidarity, I mean the things that we do because we're part of a group of people with whom we feel we share values and responsibilities. And by individual aspiration, I just mean our will to survive and to succeed. If you like, these are three voices in our heads that we hear when we've got to make a choice. I'll do what I'm told. I'll do what everyone else is doing. I'll do what I want. Now, there is a fourth way of thinking about change. These are all ways of thinking about change and also ways of pursuing change. And there's a fourth way, and which is slightly different, and that's fatalism. And that's what we do when we don't think change is possible at all, or if it is possible, it's not going to work for us. Now, to bring this alive a bit more, think of climate change and how this describes the positions people take on climate change. So the hierarchical position is what we need is a new international treaty written by scientists and experts and signed off by politicians, which is binding on everybody in the world. The solidaristic view, which is all about our responsibilities to each other, is that we need to give up eating meat and stop flying in planes and change our whole lifestyle. The individualistic view, I think well summed up by the phrase the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stone, is that it'll be solved through individual ingenuity, through markets, through innovation, through technology. We shouldn't worry so much about it. And the fatalistic view is it's all made up, and if it's not all made up, we're screwed. Now, as those examples suggest, actually the way you solve complex problems is to bring all of those perspectives together. Anyone who really wants to tackle climate change will want effective treaties. They will recognise we need to change our lifestyles, and they will want and hope that innovation and technology produces great solutions. But in contrast to the Olympics, the problem with society, I want to argue, is that those sources of social power have become unbalanced. So look first at hierarchy. I don't need to tell you, you'll all have seen the surveys, our trust in leaders, in political leaders, in chief executives, in leaders of all kinds is an all-time low. I think the Edelman Global Survey this year found 38% levels of the level of trust in leaders was 38%, lowest ever recorded. Now, why is it? Why is it that we have lost faith in hierarchical authority? Well, here's a few ideas. First of all, it's failed. 30 years ago, 1 million unemployed people would have been considered a scandal. Living standards rose year on year. Living standards for most people in Britain and America and other countries haven't risen now for about 20 or 30 years. So the hierarchy hasn't delivered the goods for most people. Also, in the face of growing accountability, often hierarchies have done just the wrong thing, which is to batten down the hatches. Think of the Catholic Church. Think of Fleet Street. Think today of how the police responded to Hillsborough. So disastrous choices by leaders in the face of growing public demands for accountability. But also, there's just been change in society. We are a much less deferential group of people than we used to be. We have higher and more differentiated expectations. And just when hierarchy thought things couldn't get any worse, along comes technology. And technology, which used to be something which strengthened the hierarchy, is now something which empowers the individual. You know, it used to be that you could only have a big computer if you're a big company. Now all of you have got more computing power in your pocket than IBM had 40 years ago. And so the individual can get access to information. And as companies know, when they suffer Twitter attacks, people can mobilize very, very quickly against hierarchies they don't think are doing the right thing. So hierarchy is enfeebled. What about social solidarity? Well, also we know that levels of trust in strangers now is lower than it has ever been before. And there's also been the decline of what sociologists call congregational institutions. Those are institutions which people bind people together, that people spend a lot of time in, which aren't just about pursuing a single issue, but are about a shared set of values in which people negotiate and work together, things like political parties, trade unions, organised church. So why has this happened? Well, I think social diversity, which is a great thing in many ways, has been partly implicated, and mobility, which is also a great thing. For 190,000 years, we evolved to trust people like ourselves. And now we have to trust and get on with people who are very different from ourselves, who live in our street, who live next door to us. Also, we've seen the fracturing of class. Many of those solidaristic institutions are based on class. But we've seen the fracturing of the working class so that we have a more affluent, aspirational working class trying to cling on to its respectability, and then we have a disadvantaged group concentrated in social housing. Think of anyone who's old enough like me to remember that council housing used to be a tenure of choice. Now it's just a tenure for people who've got no choice and got no job, generally speaking. And we've also seen a fracturing of the middle class into those, again, tenaciously trying to hold on to the middle class status, and the super rich who fly around the world as global citizens. And then finally, what about individualism? Well, individualism is what it is. It's got strengths and weaknesses. And the main problem with individualism in the modern world, actually, is the decline of hierarchy and solidarity. It's created a vacuum, and individualism has come into that vacuum, and it's kind of overburdened. But it's also the case that individualism has become narrow and materialistic, and there are particular reasons for that. There's the myth from neoclassical economics, the myth of Homo economicus, that we're all perfectly informed, utility-maximising individuals. Now, that, of course, has been a theory which was already a bit ludicrous, has been blown out of the water pretty much by the credit crunch. I don't remember, Alan Greenspan, one of the greatest understatements of all time, was asked immediately after the collapse of Lehman what he thought of that theory, and he said, well, I think he said maybe there's a flaw in the theory, he argued. So we had that ideology. Of course, we've also got the propaganda of consumerism. You know, as you walk home tonight, there'll be lots of consumer messages to tell you that being a kind of materialistic individual is great because you're worth it. And also, this is just because this is how the world feels to us. We know from all sorts of experiments that we systematically exaggerate the degrees to which what we do and who we are is a result of our individual choices, and we systematically underestimate the degree to which who we are and what we do is a consequence of the social context in which we operate. So, this is my argument, that we live in a society where hierarchy is enfeebled, social solidarity is weakened, and individualism is overburdened, and it's a narrow form of individualism. Now, what is the consequence of that? Well, I think there are two consequences of that, one which I've already referred to. And the first consequence is that we're just not developing the kinds of solutions that mobilise all those forms of social power. One example I'd give is, why is it in the face of inequality in society that the answer every politician seems to agree on is social mobility? The idea that picking a few talented individuals out of poor communities and progressing them, even if we could do it, and we don't seem to know how to do it, the idea that it would actually concentrate disadvantage in the poorest communities does nothing about the overall levels of justice and inclusion in society. It seems like the only response people can have to a big social problem like injustice is a highly individualistic response. Let's find some individuals and save them. But looking at it from other angles, you can see also that narrowness. A few weeks ago, there was a report on old people in hospital, which found that old people in hospital were very often in very squalid conditions. Their bed was wet, they were hungry, they were in a terrible way. Now, the conclusion to that report, because we tend to look at things through a hierarchical lens very often when it's the state involved, was it's the fault of managers, it was the fault of nurses. In fact, someone made the suggestion, which seemed to be a bit ludicrous, that we should teach nurses compassion. This is obviously the problem. Now, my response to that story was this. I have seen people at the end of their lives, and I've seen people in those situations of dependency, and I can tell you what the critical variable is for how they're treated. The critical variable is whether they have loved ones visiting them. So actually, whilst there might have been a managerial failure and a nursing failure, it's also a failure of the social isolation of older people. The solution may be to teach nurses compassion and get better managers. The best solution, actually, is that we don't have so many older people who are in hospitals and in homes on their own with nobody to argue for them and communicate them and spend time with them. So this is a much broader question of social responsibility in response to ageing people. But let's have a neat solution. Let's just blame it on the managers and nurses. And I've seen this time and again. You know, Labour committed to abolishing child poverty. It's a great and noble aim. It should have been something that mobilised the whole country and where we thought about how it is we could inspire the individual aspirations of poor families. Instead, it became something which the Treasury did to people through clever tax credits, through technocratic solutions. David Cameron argued for the big society. I love the idea of the big society. It's a strong notion of solidarity, renewing solidarity. David Cameron recognised this. The problem is, he had no account of why individuals would want to suddenly start volunteering, and he totally failed to get Whitehall behind this idea. So it just remained as a kind of pious notion floating around. So the first consequence of us not mobilising individualism, hierarchy and solidarity together is we come up with feeble solutions to big problems. And when you watch the politicians speak at party conference, what you'll see is you'll see high-flown rhetoric about values and then little tiny solutions, and you'll wonder, why is there such this huge imbalance between these values and these little tiny ideas that they've got? I'm offering you a solution, an explanation for that. But there's something else that's happened. There's another consequence of this imbalance. And when I was researching this speech, I came across an amazing speech given by Jimmy Carter, the American president, in 1979. And I just want to play you a few seconds of that speech.
It's clear that the true problems of our nation are much deeper, deeper than gasoline lines or energy shortages, deeper even than inflation or recession. So I want to speak to you first tonight about a subject even more serious than energy or inflation. I want to talk to you right now about a fundamental threat to American democracy. The threat is nearly invisible in ordinary ways. It is a crisis of confidence. It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will. We can see this crisis in the growing doubt about the meaning of our own lives and in the loss of a unity of purpose for our nation.
Now, about 4 days after that, the White House collapsed, and a year after that, Jimmy Carter lost power. So you can see why politicians have not found that a very a message they want to copy. But what Jimmy Carter was incredibly brave, it's a brilliant speech, by the way, it was worth watching all of it. And in fact, the public reaction immediately after it was quite good, but Carter's problems are much more fundamental politically. But what Carter was identifying for the first time was that American people did not believe the future would be better than the past, and he thought that was a remarkable and frightening thing. Ever since then, although there have been cycles, that social pessimism has deepened. And what polls find again and again is this: that individually, we tend to exaggerate our prospects. I'm afraid none of you are going to do quite as well as you think you're going to do. But socially, we are deeply pessimistic. We think the world is worse than it is, and we don't think it's going to get any better. And this social pessimism, which I believe is a reflection of some of the forces I'm talking about, that unbalancing, is in danger of becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, okay, lots of big ideas. But what are the implications of this? Does it have any kind of, is anything we can do about it practically? Well, I want to suggest three. And the first is itself quite abstract, but it matters to me because I was trained as a sociologist, if that's not a contradiction in terms. So the first point I want to make is that I think we should try and think about society as a whole. It's kind of gone out of fashion. When I was at university, there were theorists who tried to think about society as a whole, as a functioning whole. And that, as I say, it's gone out of fashion, but I think we should do that. We should try to understand society as a whole. And part of the reason that that went out of fashion is that it was associated with a school of thought called functionalism, which said that society does function as a unit and it all fits together. And that theory was discredited partly because people said, well, what about conflict and what about complexity? It's all too neat. Now, I want to suggest that my account enables us to bring together a view of society with complexity and with conflict. Because not only is it the case that we need solutions which combine individualism, hierarchical authority and solidarity, but the fascinating thing is these solutions will never be very stable, and the reason for that is because all of these perspectives hate each other. There is a fundamental conflict between these different ways of viewing the world, so just as we try and push them together, they will always be jostling with each other. In fact, they get their energy from their opposition to each other. You know, hierarchies get their energy from the fact they've got to control the risk-taking individualists and the backward-looking people organising the demo or whatever. People in solidaristic organisations are always against the hierarchy, and again, they're threatened by individualism. I saw a great example of this a few weeks ago, going from the grand to the very parochial, a few months ago. I was at an underground station, and people were queuing up because the trains were delayed. And so we're all standing in the queue. So this queue was a combination of two of the things I've described to you: hierarchy, but also that fatalism I discussed. We were standing in the queue because we were told to stand in the queue. The orders were to stand in the queue, and we were standing in the queue because everything bloody well goes wrong and I'm never on time for work, right? Then what happened was a few people, they might have been in a hurry, they might have been megalomaniacs, I don't know, but they realized that you could duck under the barrier and you could walk up the exit and get to the front of the queue. So a few people did this. And what was interesting was the queue changed its form. We started murmuring to each other. And we stopped being just a hierarchical queue, and we became a solidaristic queue. We were a queue defined by the fact that we subscribed to the values of queuing, as distinct from these horrible individualists who were doing their own thing. So I want to argue that we can think about society as a whole, and we can understand how it functions, and we can recognise the need for these three forces to be held together, whilst recognising that they're also kind of centrifugal forces, which mean that they're always fighting each other, and that solutions are never fully stable. The second implication, of course, is that we have to think about how it is we renew and reshape the forces of power that I've described. And I could do, I could give a speech about each of these, and so I'll just be bullet points. But first of all, hierarchy. How might we renew hierarchy? Well, I think, first of all, we need leaders who tell it how it is. And I don't think we have that at the moment. Barack Obama, last week, he is one of the leaders who's most consistently done this. He said in his speech last week, "Don't look to me for change. In the end, change depends upon you. And all I can do is what you choose to do." Of course, it's not a new message. Kennedy said the same thing 50 years before him. But we need leaders who kind of tell us the truth about how little power they have got unless they can engage us in the process of change that they're describing. Secondly, I think we need leaders who are both, on the one hand, more ambitious about what they want to achieve, inspire us a bit, but at the same time are much more devolved in the way in which they try and make change happen. I think at the moment we have leaders who are controlling but not very ambitious. So it's the reverse of that. It's interesting, we had Richard Florida in this room on Monday, who's a great expert on cities, and we were just talking about why is it that city leaders around the world are so much more popular than national leaders. And it's because they're closer to the people. So we need great ambition, but we need to understand that solutions increasingly need to be local and engage people at a local level. And then thirdly, we need a new ethic of leadership, whether it's Royal Bank of Scotland or MPs or whatever it is, we need a new ethic of leadership. And for me, this is fundamentally about reflexivity. It's about leaders who think about leadership and are aware of the perils of leadership and who welcome accountability because they know that being a leader is a dangerous thing. Secondly, how do we renew solidarity? Well, first of all, I'm fascinated by the work that's going on right now as we deepen empathy. There's a wonderful project, many of you will have heard of it, called Roots of Empathy, which takes very small babies into classrooms and children play with them, and it seems to have a powerful impact on their capacity for empathy. So we have to understand how it is we encourage empathy, because for me, in the 21st century, the ability to trust and get on with people different to yourself is a critical 21st century capability, and it's one that we need to explore how we develop in young people. Secondly, we need to understand social networks better. This is something the RSA has made a bit of a specialism. We are understanding more and more that people's social networks, the social networks which exist in communities, are vital to the resilience of those communities, to the opportunities. And I think the more we understand about social networks, the more we'll be able to use those to bring people together to find solutions. And then thirdly, we've got to try to renew those old institutions that I said are in decline. Actually, there's some good examples. The Scouts, the Women's Institute, I like to think the RSA are examples of old institutions which have taken risks and have become relevant in the modern world. We need the same kind of risk-taking in our political parties, for example. We need to renew those institutions. Then finally, we have to recast individualism. As I said before, I don't think the fundamental problem with individualism is it's not restrained by hierarchy and solidarity. That's its problem. It's hubristic. But it is also narrow. And so I'll just give you three names. Aristotle, Dan Gilbert, and Nicolas Sarkozy. Aristotle, because he said things like, "Should we not say that he is happy whose acts are virtuous and has adequate external goods for his lifetime?" So we should learn from Aristotle a slightly deeper and moralistic account of what it is to be a successful individual. You should all read Dan Gilbert's book, Stumbling into Happiness, which I read a few years ago and influenced me enormously, because what Dan Gilbert shows is that we are very, very bad at predicting what's going to make us happy. In fact, we're extremely bad at even describing what made us happy in the past. So that might help us get off the kind of treadmill of thinking that buying a new car and the latest thing is going to make us happy, because generally it doesn't. And good old Nicolas Sarkozy, he may have lost power, but he did set up the commission, a huge commission on exploring kind of well-being and happiness, which has influenced debate around the world. And so maybe out of that, and we're doing it in Britain as well, we will get a richer understanding of the kind of things that make us happy. I often say you can sum up happiness research in one sentence, which is, if you want to be happy for a year, get married. If you want to be happy for a decade, get a dog. If you want to be happy for the whole of your life, get a garden. I'm afraid that is basically the evidence. So maybe these kinds of insights will help us to have a slightly richer kind of idea of what it is to be a successful individual. And then finally, the third thing I think you get out of this perspective, as well as thinking about society as a whole, as well as understanding how we have to renew the sources of social power, is I think it changes the way we think about organisations and problems. I think organisations often suffer from the fact that they don't mobilise those three forms of power. Public service organisations traditionally are good at hierarchy and they're good at solidarity. They're not terribly good at individualism. They're not very good at creating environments for risk-taking and enterprise. But when organisations, by the way, have just got one of those forces, they can be very, very dangerous. Banks. These were institutions with no hierarchical oversight because no one in charge knew what was going on. Absolutely no sense of social responsibility. They were hyper-individualistic cultures. They were bound to go wrong. Unfortunately, we gave them an enormous amount of power. Communes, another great example. Communes always fail. The only communes that ever survive are ones that have hierarchies because solidarity on its own is disastrous because no one can decide whose turn it is to do the cooking. Look at the Soviet Union. That's another example of a culture that collapsed because it was overwhelmingly hierarchical. Anyway, the point I'm making is when we think about organisations, we should think about how it is organisations mobilise those different sources of power, bring them together, recognising their dynamism. And also, we need this approach to how it is we solve problems. And what that's led me to, it's led me to a change in my whole way of thinking since I've been at the RSA. I used to be a policy wonk. And now I increasingly think that the policy frame is not the way to solve problems. The design frame is the way to solve problems. And so this approach, I think, leads us to think about problems as a designer would, which is to spend more time really understanding the problem and also getting the fact that the problem looks different depending where you're looking at it from. So let me give you an example, a piece of work the RSA is doing, publishing next week. We've been looking at the informal economy. So this is an issue that's been around forever. All these people who don't pay taxes and then they're not in the legitimate economy, they're taking a risk. And every few years, the government tries to do something about it and it achieves absolutely nothing. Now, again, there are three ways that you might tackle the informal economy. Hierarchical ways to have stronger rules, regulation, and enforcement. The solidaristic way is to say, what about the social norms? How many of you have paid cash in hand? You know, don't we need to increase the sense of taboo on people working in the informal economy and paying out in the informal economy? And the individualistic way is, how do we incentivize these individuals to go formal, to go legit? And the reality is you need a solution that combines those things at the same time as recognizing that if you do too much of one, the whole thing will destabilize. So if you give people, individuals, too many incentives, then people who've always been legitimate will say, why are these people getting extra money to go straight when I've always gone straight? And if the hierarchy gets too officious, then the community, which could have been on their side, will turn against them, just like they did with that conservative minister who talked about the informal economy a few weeks ago, and everyone said, why are you talking about window cleaners? You should be talking about bankers. So it's a way of solving problems that looks at them from multiple angles and tries to get to the heart of what the difficulty is. And it also leads to an approach to problem solving, unlike policymakers who try and have a once-and-for-all solution, which is much more incremental and much more flexible, because you recognise that as these ways of solving problems interact with each other, all sorts of unpredictable things happen. So you have to have solutions which enable you, rather like someone moulding a clay pot, to constantly adjust. And that's a huge challenge for how we do policy, but I think that's how we have to make policy to tackle complex problems. So, the Olympics was special. And as I say, over the next few weeks, we will have to endure every political speech seeking to hijack it. Someone told me there is already a website dedicated to, apparently, excuse my language, Olympic bullshit bingo. So I've tried to get ahead of the game. I've argued that the lesson we should learn from the Olympics is this. If we combine responsible and trusted authority, shared commitment and mutual support, and the firepower of individual ambition, and we combine them understanding their inherent dynamism and tensions, then whilst we will never host the Olympics again in our lifetimes, we can start to close that social aspiration gap, and we can rekindle our belief in a better future. Thank you.
Matthew Taylor, delivering the 2012 RSA Chief Executive's Lecture, The Power to Act, A New Angle on Our Toughest Problems. You're on Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/Radio National. I'm Paul Barclay. Let's return now to London, where Matthew Taylor responds to questions from the floor. Here's our moderator, political columnist, writer and BBC Radio 4 broadcaster, Jenny Russell.
Just before we open this to the floor, I'm going to ask you a few questions. And one thing I wanted to say before I challenged you on some of your ideas and some of your arguments, because that is what you'd expect. What's the genesis of these ideas?
The background to this thinking is a set of ideas developed by the anthropologist Mary Douglas. and it's often called a grid group theory. And basically what Mary Douglas did was she identified, if you think of a 2x2 matrix, she identified four points in this matrix. Grid is the level of stratification in a society, and group is the level of membership.
Matthew, I'm already regretting asking you this question. Okay. Make it a bit simpler for those
that
are sitting at home.
I knew that. And what she argued was that in high grid, high group societies, that was a hierarchical society, so people felt a sense of belonging, but they were very stratified. Low group, low grid societies were individualistic. There wasn't much stratification, there wasn't much sense of belonging. High group, low grid was like a commune, so we all had a sense of belonging but no stratification. And high grid, low group was like a prison. That was fatalism, because you were stuck in the hierarchy but you had no sense that you were part of anything. And from that theory, a group of other theorists called cultural theorists identified these four these states, the hierarchical, solidaristic, individualistic and fatalistic. What I've done is take those ideas and try to apply them to contemporary Britain, to explore how that set of ideas, which has normally been applied by theorists to particular problems and particularly to risk, actually, to the nature of risk. And it occurred to me that actually this is quite an interesting frame through which we can think about modern society.
I think that's fascinating, but what strikes me listening to you is that I was listening to Tory theorists before the last election who were genuinely concerned about exactly this kind of issue. They felt that Britain had become too statist, too hierarchical, under Labour, and at the same point also too individualistic. And the Big Society was a genuine attempt to bring people together and to appeal to their sense that there was something beyond themselves. Now, in a way, they did exactly what you're talking about, which is they tried to inspire from the top and then leave people to work out their solutions from the bottom. And we've all seen how badly that worked out. And yet they were absolutely convinced that this would work. How would you set about actually turning these grand ideas into something real?
Well, I think when it comes to the Big Society, which I guess is what you're talking about, it was an idea that I thought was powerful, and I argued in support of it at the time, and I thought, by the way, that Labour was wrong to dismiss it. However, I think that the problem with it is partly that the idea is not that you just get rid of hierarchy. Hierarchy is always there. The question is, do you use it effectively or do you not use it effectively? And I think that what happened was with the Big Society, it felt too often like it was just, let's just take the state away and something will flourish. And actually the question is, how can the state be supportive and so that it can actually muster social solidarity? And then the other thing was, there was, funnily enough for conservatives in terms of the Big Society, no individualism in it. What was actually going to lead people to want to do this stuff? You know, I mean, the idea that just your library closing was enough to get you out on the streets. Now, it's very interesting to look at the Olympics and those volunteers. There may be volunteers in the room, and you're wonderful people, but I guess part of the reason you did it was because it was exciting, and you got a uniform, because people came up to you on the tube and said, you're fantastic, you know? So, you know, actually, it's not... People need that kind of stuff. They need to feel that they do, when they do the right thing, that they get something out of it themselves. So I think the Big Society was good diagnosis, and it's not out of line what I said, but as a way of doing things, it was typically of government. It was too narrow, it was unrealistic, and of course committed the ultimate folly of all hierarchies, which is to kind of say, we can do this in 2 years and everything will be great. You know?
The question that I'm really left with listening to you is that what human history seems to teach us, and you are moving towards this, is that you actually have to have institutions in which people can act, that people can't really invent them all by themselves. And I was very struck earlier this year reading a fascinating book, which I recommend to everyone in the room, Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind. I don't know if any of you have heard of it. He's a liberal American psychologist who's written this book because he's concerned about the enormous divide in American society between the right and the left. And basically he says that liberals don't understand the importance of structure and authority and ritual and religion in people's lives. And he points out that we are engaged in the West, in liberal societies, in an unprecedented experiment where we're taking apart all the institutions that traditionally have constrained and contained people's worst natures and brought them together and taught them how to cooperate without wanting to kill one another. And because we say these may in some ways be too sexist or not diverse enough, we're just chucking them away, and that the bonds between people therefore are fraying in a way that we don't know what the consequences are going to be. Now, when you talk about this, this is exactly what you're identifying. But what would you advocate, apart from a few more scouts and women's institutes? Should the left be turning around and saying, yes, you know, these traditional institutions, we have to bolster them, because on the whole, we've just been mocking them?
Yeah, I think that whether it's the left or the right, we have to understand that there's something special about what I might call thick membership rather than a thin membership. You know, we've all got loads of thin membership organisations.
Facebooks and...
Facebooks or charities that we sign up to and we send them 20 quid a year and we sign a petition. But that kind of thicker membership that you get from the church, from a trade union, from some of these older sort of professional associations, that is valuable. And I think that, I mean, it's interesting, for example, that the RSA spent a lot of energy in the last 5 years, and I'm really proud of it, into proper engagement with our fellows and supporting our fellows in being people who make change happen in society. But one of the things I've noticed is if you look at most membership organisations, in the last 30 or 40 years, they've got so much better at direct mail and fundraising, but they've done virtually nothing to improve deeper engagement. So I think lots of institutions have just there's a decline is for various reasons, but part of the reason of decline is we've just adopted this kind of individualistic way of thinking about people's affiliations. And actually, we've got to go back to a deeper notion of affiliation. And institutions are vital. It is in institutions that solidarity expresses itself. You can also foster solidarity in communities, but it is primarily in institutions. So we do need institutional renewal. And the state of political parties, for example, is a kind of catastrophe, actually, an absolute catastrophe. And the fact that politicians are beholden to them as they get smaller and smaller and more representative is is disastrous. We shouldn't attack political parties. We should think, how do we renew them so that they can actually represent a broad base in society?
Well, with that self-interested argument, how would you say to individuals, this is a reason why you should engage in these thick institutions which are going to ask more of you than you may want to give?
Oh, well, that's very simple, because it makes you happy. All the evidence is it does. You know, people who have religious conviction are happier than people who don't. And I'm not there commenting whether or not God exists. I'll do that lecture next year. But
Give the answer.
The point is that being with people who share your values and share a common sense of purpose is something which people enjoy. People get a lot out of. If institutions are respecting to you and engage you in the right way, then people get an enormous amount out of that. And I think, you know, anyone in this room knows that if you get that kind of sense of shared purpose, it adds something which all the kind of baubles of individual success don't bring to your life.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to take some questions in the room, and I'm going to take them in a new RSA, very hierarchical principle. I've been told to try taking three questions from each block. Hand going up there from the gentleman in blue. I'll take three at a time, please. Can you say who you are?
Sure. Cyrus Bedwar, fellow of the RSA. Matthew, thank you for that lecture very much. I wonder, in terms of following on Jenny's question, in terms of how do we make this real, what are your thoughts on the role of social enterprise as a vehicle for addressing some of the issues you've raised?
Thank you. Wonderfully concise. I love it. Any more questions from this side?
Alex Johns, a fellow. I see big society perhaps as cast in the wrong light, and it's perhaps more of a long-term movement. As such, is it not unfair just to look at it so soon, and perhaps you need to look at it through the prism of 20 years, 50 years, or something like that?
I'll tell Steve Hilton there's life in it yet, in your opinion. He'll be very pleased. Gentleman behind there, thank you.
The big society, the only way it is going to work is to have institutions that people can join and need to be sponsored by the government and encouraged by the government. The ones that I look at, for example, where we get a lot of engagement in the place that I live, is the RSPB, but they have leaders within it. People can then join and feel they are committing and contributing, but they have money behind that leadership. We need the money.
Okay. I think social enterprise is a really exciting thing. I think it's part of a questioning of the younger generation in particular, who say, actually, we like the idea of enterprise, and we published some research yesterday that showed how younger people, today's young generation, are more interested in entrepreneurship than any generation previously. But they don't assume that enterprise means get rich as quickly as you can, send out your business and go and play golf. So I think that is part of... I mean, what I'm describing is kind of what I think needs to change, but I also could have given another speech saying I think that a lot of this is imminent. I think it's happening. I think hierarchies, in the end, will have to adapt to their loss of credibility. I do think individualism is changing. People are questioning it. I think we will see new forms of solidarity. So I'm kind of describing what I think will emerge. The question is, can we kind of hasten it? So I think social enterprise is really encouraging that so many young people want to combine enterprise with a sense of social responsibility. When it comes to Big Society, now, the Big Society is right. It's just the brand I'm talking about. It's a kind of you know, it was a disastrous bit of political communication. I mean, this is my other job, you know, when I used to be superficial. It's a disastrous piece of political strategy. Because first of all, they say we're creating something which lots of people are doing already, so that pisses off all the people are doing already. And then they say we're going to make this happen in 2 or 3 years, when they're not. So Cameron was right that in the end, we are going to have a different set of attitudes, and people are going to have to become better at meeting their own needs individually and collectively. There's no question, absolutely no question about that. But it was a hubristic form of communication, to be honest. And unfortunately, also, there's a huge suspicion about it within the Conservative Party. So the rest of the government, because if you're a Conservative, the idea of a big society sounds very anti-Burke. It doesn't really sound like a Conservative idea. So, you know, so we will go back to it, even if we don't use capital B, capital S. RSPB, well, two things. I mean, I think you're right about money, but the RSPB, in the end, rather like the RSA, it's relatively small contributions of people who are members. I don't think it requires kind of big state funding. It requires lots and lots of little people to come together. And one of the encouraging things about the internet, actually, is new ways for lots of people to gather together little tiny bits of money and make things happen. What I think is interesting about RSPB, it's a great example of actually what institutions do. We had Chris Smith speaking here a few months ago, and he talked about how people join the RSPB because they're enthusiastic about a particular bird, and then they find out about that bird's habitat, and then they find out how that habitat's being affected by environmental change, and then they want to know about how the climate works. And I think that's how institutions work, actually. People get involved very often for you know, smaller reasons, and then through their engagement, they get a much deeper understanding and they think about society much more broadly.
Thank you. Some more questions, please. Gentleman here.
David Pearson Fellow. Matthew, wonderful presentation, really enjoyed it. You quite rightly talked about the Olympics, but you didn't actually mention the Paralympics. And I wonder whether you would agree with me that there are one or two lessons you could specifically learn from the Paralympics. For example, the reason I think why it works is classification, which enables people with different levels of disability to compete, but in strata. So the blind compete against the blind, and people with cerebral palsy compete against cerebral palsy. In a society at large, we've rejected that, and we seem to want one solution for everybody, even though it's probably not appropriate for very large numbers of people.
That's a fascinating analogy. Thank you. Can we take the lady over there? Sorry, I'm just breaking my rule here.
Thank you. Angela Harvey, a fellow of the RSA. Matthew, I'd love you to reflect on the media for a moment. Thank you.
Crumbs. In what length of time would you like him to reflect on the media? And lady here.
Hi, fellow and counterpoint. We are having this discussion today about institutions, and I wonder whether social networks like Facebook, Twitter can qualify as institutions, or is it a temporal thing, or is it a physical thing?
Great questions. I think it's a really brilliant point about the Paralympics, and I think, you know, I love the Olympics, but I wrote a bit at the time that we should be a little bit careful about taking the values of the Olympics and thinking they're the right values for the rest of society. Because I don't want a society where if you win, you become an international superstar, and if you're fourth, you're kind of forgotten. So, you know, it's great, but that's sport, and there's a kind of what works in sport doesn't necessarily work for the rest of society. And I think you're right that in the Paralympics, the emphasis upon participation and effort better balanced the emphasis upon individual achievement. That's one of the reasons why we found it in a way even more inspiring, and I think that is a powerful story for society as a whole. And I worry that there'll be that the Olympics will be reinforcing this notion of social mobility which I described earlier, this very kind of linear idea of there's one thing to be, and as long as we can get a few more people to be that thing, then society is healthy. In relation to Angela's point, of course Angela's a mayor, so she doesn't admit that she's part of the hierarchy, but no, but it's an important, yeah, I know.
Could the rest of us know what she's mayor of Netherlands?
Westminster. No, I wasn't, Andrew, saying it disparagingly at all. I think that in terms of the media, and you know this, anyone who's involved in politics anyway knows this, the problem with the media is that it gets in the way of what I said in my speech, which is the need to tell it the way it is. You know, the fact is, when you look at public opinion, and, you know, if you're in local government or national government, you know, as I used to be a local councillor, the problem is that we've said that politics is like consumerism. And this is bonkers, because, you know, if I go to a Sainsbury's and I buy healthy food throughout, and right at the end I buy a massive packet of biscuits, that's kind of up to me. But in politics, it's a bit of a problem that people say they want lower taxes and better services, that they want more power decentralised, but they want services to be the same wherever they live, that they want climate change tackled, but they want cheaper petrol. And we've kind of said to people, you can have whatever you want, even if what you want doesn't make any sense. And so politicians tell us we can have what we want, even though it doesn't make any sense, and then we get angry with them because they don't give us what we want, and they couldn't have given us what we want because it didn't make sense in the first place. Now, actually, politicians need to do a bit of what Barack Obama did a little bit last week, and politicians do from time to time, and they need to do more of it, which is to kind of say to us, no, actually, you know, part of being in authority, part of being a mayor, part of being an MP, part of being a Prime Minister, is saying to the public, actually, you know, you've elected me, and I'm going to do some stuff you don't want me to do, but it's going to be the right thing to do. And one of the reasons the Olympics worked, this is a really important thing, why did the Olympics work? Because once we won the bid, we just had to deliver it. It's not like bloody runways, you know, where people can say, oh, we'll have to have another inquiry. You know, we might not have liked the lanes or the, you know, the buildings or the money, but we just had to do it, yeah? And actually, sometimes hierarchical authority has to be like that. And, you know, the media is a kind of disorganized conspiracy to maintain the population in a perpetual state of self-righteous rage. So when politicians ought to be, as it were, putting us on the couch and saying, look, I know you're angry, but you've got to kind of come to terms with it in order that we can find a way of going forward. Instead, there's someone else in the room saying, don't listen to this bastard, you can have whatever you want. So the problem with the media is not too left-wing or too right-wing, but it tends to reinforce our sense that it's the politicians letting us down, and often it's actually our own preferences. But that's not true of everyone in the media, and I think there's change in the media as well. And certainly, you know, if you read columns of someone like Jenny, then that's much more thoughtful. But I think historically, that's been the problem in the media, is it's kind of encouraged us to think that politicians should give us what we want, whatever it is. And then finally, in relation to social networks, I think this is a big issue. I think we've been waiting a long time to see how online networks turn into real networks, and how they also develop that kind of thicker congregational feel that I was talking about. And I kind of feel it's bound to happen, but yet we have to recognise that probably in view of the aspirate hopes that we might have had, it's not quite happening as much as we want. And also, for example, we hoped, so many people hoped, I remember over the years, some people come to me saying, I've got this new website and it's going to get people who disagree with each other to talk to each other. It turns out people who disagree with each other don't want to talk to each other on the internet, they just want to abuse each other. So I do think we've got to do more work on how it is the internet does provide a first step for people into that kind of thicker association. And lots of people have tried, I don't think it's necessarily succeeded, but I might just be saying that because I'm an old fart.
Oh no, I don't think so. Anyone who's taken part in a Twitter row will know how right you are about that. Thank you. You're going to take the lady at the end here.
I'm Jessica Townsend, and I'm not a member of the Royal Society.
That's fine.
good.
We'll get you on the way out.
I've got two questions. The first to do with the way that you framed your lecture. The first is, it seemed to me that you're framing things within this sort of national country sort of area, but it seems to me that a lot of the problems that we deal with today are actually outside of that. Mm. And so what is the point, if we get all of our institutions in balance, what's the point of that if there is then a correction in the international field? We cannot, at the moment, we don't seem to be able to get it together as a nation. We certainly can't get it together as Europe, or Europe can't get it together. And if the people with the money, the international banking, the corporations, are not paying tax, are evading national
Jessica,
laws...
Jessica, can you be a bit speedy about
your point? How can we, within your framework, tackle that?
Hang on, you've got another two to come before you leave in there. Lady here at the front.
Radia Half is a fellow of the RSA. I think it's very interesting, the kind of combination of the individual, the solidarity and the hierarchy. But I really wish you would ditch happiness, Matthew, because I think it's taking us on the wrong track. It's very autocratic and very prescriptive. We're not here tonight because it makes us happy. We're here because it's about ideas and ideals. And I really wish you would look more at the ideas that could drive people and do drive people.
Yeah. In Matthew's defence, doesn't thinking about ideas make the people here happy? I think that's why they're here. Is there another question from...
How does last week's independent newspaper initiative fit in with what you've said to us tonight, if it fits in at all? The idea being, as I'm sure you know, to have people elected in 2015 for one term only, without any political party affiliation at all, and with a mission to ensure that systems are established that get people involved in our democracy in ways that they're not involved in at the moment.
Thank you.
Okay, brilliant. International, there's two answers to that question, and they're very different. The first is, I want to say slightly beware the idea that globalization means everyone has to be the same. You know, you can succeed in the world as Sweden or Finland, and you can succeed in the world in a different kind of way by being, well, America's not really succeeding. I mean, you know what I mean? There are different routes. And there's a kind of lazy assumption that says, you know, we can't afford welfare states and it's a kind of race to the bottom. And, you know, that's not the case. I was in Finland last week and that's a completely different country. And there's no, you know, what we're in Finland, they don't say, oh my goodness, we've got to change. We've got to become more like Britain. Maybe apart from the weather. So that's one thing. The second thing is you're right, absolutely. And part of, if I could make the same speech internationally, and what I would argue internationally is that you're right, the individualism, which is the market in this case, is massively advanced. And certain forms of solidarity, like crime, criminal networks, are pretty well advanced. And there is a problem in international terms about that lack of hierarchy. And I can't remember the name of the author who's come up with the concept of the G0, the lack of international governance and the kind of problem. So you're right, one of the difficulties of globalization is that certain of those forces have been unleashed by it, and other forces are kind of lagging behind, notably civil society and hierarchical capacity. In relation to happiness, you know, you're right. I just was being lazy. So I much prefer a kind of Aristotelian notion of virtue and the good life. I just mean that people say they want to be happy and they make unwise choices even in relation to that narrow concept. So I don't think happiness is a particularly helpful idea. I think eudaimonia or fulfillment or all these better ideas. But what I'm simply saying is we're not very good at doing it. We think we're very good at it and we're not. And maybe that would help us to have slightly more rounded, to redefine it and to understand that we should maybe listen to the philosophers a bit more and maybe think about how we pursue happiness or how we pursue well-being, which you don't like either as a phrase, I suspect. And then...
elections from 2015.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure about that idea. And as I say, I don't think the answer is to get rid of political parties, because what they do is they just decline and they become like a kind of hand around our throats. You know, as they shrivel, they squeeze them. But I do think we should think about big innovation. I mean, for example, if I'd been reforming the House of Lords, I would have had a really significant part of it elected by lots or by some form of kind of lottery or something. So that there was, in the second house, a significant number of citizens who were just, as it were, ordinary citizens, not come through political parties. And for two reasons. One, because it would have been live in debate. But secondly, actually, because they would have, after a year, said, you know, this stuff isn't very easy. You know, it's no good just hating politicians. It's actually quite hard, this stuff. And I think that would have helped the public debate, because they would have realised that it's not just lifetime politicians who say things that you don't want to hear. It's actually a tough kind of process.
Matthew, thank you very much indeed.
Matthew Taylor, Chief Executive of the RSA. Our thanks to the moderator, Jenny Russell, the RSA, and Simon Field for making that lecture available to us.